If you were to visit the Oval Office, you would see that one of the quotes that President Obama chose to weave around the outer edge of the presidential seal that's there in the center of the room is from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. That the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Dr. King, in turn, was directly quoting the 19th century abolitionist and Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker. In the short term, both King and Parker are right, that if you're seeking to live a moral life, you will be led to act for peace and justice in the world. But as we heard in the bright and cheery, full of unicorns and cupcakes spoken meditation, in the longest of long terms, science tells us that ultimately it is not love that wins, but entropy. And rather than bending toward justice, the universe is ultimately heading toward an inevitable heat death. But that's 1 trillion, trillion, trillion years from now, so we're good. In all seriousness, though, many ethical systems formally, and even some today, hold that we should act morally only because of some variation on a cosmic carrot and stick system. That if you do good, you will be blessed eternally in an afterlife, and if you do bad, then you'll be punished eternally. But given what we know about our marginal place in the 13.8 billion-year-old evolution story, as well as our place in a universe of perhaps as many as 500 billion other galaxies, perhaps that cosmic, you know, it's not all about us, as it turns out, with that cosmic carrot and stick system. So what would it mean anyway to choose meaning, to choose community, to still choose hope? Even if our choices aren't eternally significant, they are still deeply impactful here and now. In light of all that we know here in the early 21st century as heirs to Copernicus, Darwin, Freud, and so many other paradigm shifters, one of the people who has helped me most in how do we live ethically today is the late American pragmatist philosopher Richard Rorty. In the late 90s, as an undergraduate philosophy major, I first read his book, Contingency, Irony, Solidarity, in which he seeks to lay that out over three parts, like how radically historically contingent most of what we do. If any of you are students of history, know how contingent why most of what we do is based on contingent historical circumstances, therefore leading Rorty to think we have sort of this essentially ironic relationship to why anything is the way it is. But for him, the challenge of the book is to choose solidarity with one another anyway. Back in 1990, the New York Times called Rorty the most influential contemporary American philosopher. He's also been called in a field of philosophy known as being kind of hard reading and dry and boring. He's been called the most interesting philosopher writing at the time, at the height of his popularity. I've continued to read a lot of Rorty in the years since, including the 500-page, quite small print, Rorty Reader. So that's a great overview of his work if you're feeling ambitious. But if the sermon leaves you not quite that curious to learn more, but somewhat curious to learn more, there's a quite accessible 140-page book with much more space between the lines and much bigger font called Achieving Our Country that I would recommend to you. It's a call for us to live into the best ideals of the American experiment. And as I've learned more about Rorty, one thing in particular stood out to me. I was fascinating to find out not only did this world-class philosopher get 2 C's in college, 2 of those C's were in philosophy classes. So no matter, some early stumbling doesn't have to hold you back from success. And part of the reason why Rorty got those 2 C's, even in his major field, was that he was suffering from depression, which runs in his family. But eventually he was able to get some help and continue to persevere and succeed. Another significant part of Rorty's story is that his maternal grandfather was Walter Rauschenbusch, one of the leaders in the social gospel movement in the early 20th century. The social gospel emphasized that the gospel in the Christian tradition, that word literally means, it comes from the Greek word euangelion, which means good news, he was saying. So the social good news, or that the gospel is really something social in nature. It was taught that Jesus lived and taught, what he lived and taught was less about saving individuals from hell in a next world and much more of some sort of social attempt to create a just world here and now. What Jesus called the kingdom of God, what more contemporary leaders like Dr. King have called the beloved community. Following in these footsteps, both of Rorty's parents were freelance writers and activists. And looking to the current generation, it's significant to note that Paul Rauschenbusch, Walter Rauschenbusch's great-grandson, is also an ordained activist, an ordained minister and an activist on the national scale. Paul and his husband, Brad Gooch, have one son who is the namesake of their famous ancestor, Walter. Now, I've taken the time to lay out those connections because, following the philosopher Alastair MacIntyre, I think there is truth in the claim that I can only answer the question, what am I to do, if I answer the previous question of what story or stories do I find myself a part? I can only answer the question, what am I to do, if I answer the previous question, what story or stories do I find myself a part? In that spirit, consider this quote from Rorty's autobiographical essay. He writes, "When I was 12, the most salient books on my parents' bookshelf," and before I tell you, think back to your childhood. What were the books that really stood out on your, or whatever house you grew up in, whether it's your parents or not, what books stood out to you in your childhood? He writes that at 12, the most salient books were two red-bound volumes, The Case of Leon Trotsky and Not Guilty. These made up the report of the Dewey Commission of Inquiry into the Moscow Trials. He said, "I never read them with the wide-eyed fascination that I brought to books like Kraft Ebling's Psychopathia Sexualis. But," he says, "I thought of them in the way in which other children thought of their family's Bible. They were the books that radiated redemptive truth and moral splendor. If I were a really good boy, I would say to myself, I should have read not only the Dewey Commission reports, but also Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution, a book I started many times but never managed to finish. For in the 1940s, he writes, the Russian Revolution and its betrayal by Stalin were for me what the Incarnation and its betrayal by Catholics had been to precocious little Lutherans 400 years earlier." Rorty writes, "I grew up knowing that all decent people were, if not Trotskyites, at least socialists. And working as an unpaid office boy during my 12th winter, I carried drafts of press releases from the Workers' Defense League office, and on the subway, I would read those documents that I had been carrying. And they told me a lot about what factory workers did to union organizers, about what plantation owners did to sharecroppers, about what the White Locomotive Engineers Union was doing to colored firemen, whose jobs those white men now wanted, now that diesel engines were replacing the coal-fired steam engines. So at 12, I knew that the point of being human was to spend one's life fighting against social injustice." What stories or story did you find yourself a part as a child? And perhaps much more importantly, what story or what stories are you choosing to be a part of? Are you choosing to weave into your narrative now for your future and for future generations that you will tell stories to? As we considered earlier, realizing that we humans are not the center of the universe, that there really is no center to the universe, that we are merely the third rock from the sun that is on the periphery of one spiral galaxy that is one among perhaps as many as 500 billion galaxies in the universe, that could lead one to nihilistic despair at our insignificance as a species in the grand scheme of things. Assuming there is a grand scheme of things, right? That's another sermon topic. But after Darwin, as you've heard me say before, we know that we are not a little lower than the angels, but merely a little higher than the apes, and deeply interconnected with the ecosystems of this planet. But there are ways we can choose to reframe and approach that narrative differently. From the perspective of American pragmatism, Rorty writes, to say that we are clever animals, you know, just a little higher than the apes, that's not to say something just philosophical and pessimistic, as if we were sitting around a cafe in France, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, and looking at the Arc de Triomphe. It is potentially to be saying something political and something hopeful. Namely, that if we can work together, we can make ourselves into whatever we clever animals can imagine ourselves into becoming. This is to set aside merely theoretical abstract questions such as, what is man? You know, who am I? What is art? And to substitute the question, what sort of world am I handing on to my grandchildren? That sort of seven-generation thinking, that ethical decisions should honor the wisdom going three generations back to your great-grandparents and consider the legacy going three generations forward to your great-grandchildren, can be an incredibly fruitful and life-giving way of being in the world. Indeed, in the late 1700s, our forebears on the universalist side of our UU heritage began rejecting the idea that God would damn any human being to infinite punishment for what at most in this life could be finite sin. They just thought that was deeply cruel and a God not worth believing in. Over time, though, that universalist strand of our UU heritage let go of that focus on rejecting hell in the next world and began to affirm, let's take care of what we do know and can do something about, loving the hell out of this world. Relatedly, Rorty writes that it turns out that the willingness to endure suffering for the sake of future reward, that's that carrot and stick system, so the willingness to endure suffering for some future reward, it turns out that that is transferable from individual rewards to social ones, from one's hope for paradise for oneself to one's hope for one's grandchildren. Can you hear the influence there of his grandfather, Walter Rauschenbusch, and that the gospel is not individual but social? That influence two generations back to his grandfather that lived on in his life? Listen again. It turns out that willingness to endure suffering for the sake of future reward is transferable from individual rewards to social ones, from one's hope for paradise for oneself to one's hope for one's grandchildren. Now, none of us know with certainty what the universe will look like 1 trillion, trillion, trillion years from now. None of us know with certainty what will or won't happen after we die. But Rorty's vision calls us, regardless, to do what we can do here and now, to choose meaning, to choose community, to choose hope for ourselves and for the generations to come. Recently, the Reverend Peter Morales, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, wrote that, you know, despite all of the theological and the philosophical diversity within Unitarian Universalism, this big tent that we're a part of, he continues to see that despite all that diversity, we all believe that things, one thing we do all believe is that things don't have to be the way they are. We refuse to accept that inequality, hatred, environmental destruction, racism, and war are just inevitable parts of the human condition. We believe that we can and have made things better, especially when we act together. And part of how we live into that promise is by being intentional about the stories we choose to tell about ourselves and the stories that we choose to pass on to future generations. In so doing, we really can shift paradigms and create a new normal. In a little more than a week, as a nation, we will celebrate the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And in recent years, a significant monument was built in his honor, overlooking the tidal basin, looking toward the Jefferson Memorial. But consider, in Rorty's words, how implausible the idea of celebrating King's birthday would have seemed to J. Edgar Hoover at the time of Selma. Things can change, things have changed. To update that analogy, the generations growing up in the wake of last year's Obergefell versus Hodges Supreme Court decision are going to come to awareness in a world in which marriage equality is normal in all 50 states. Earlier, I referenced Rorty's call for us to live into the best ideals of the American experiment, and expanding our focus to just the past few centuries here in the U.S., Rorty writes about the potential of increasing numbers of people coming to more fully appreciate both the social progress we have made and, accordingly, how much more is possible when we choose meaning and we choose community and we choose hope. Such a shift would mean, in Rorty's words, acquiring an image of ourselves as heirs to a tradition of increasing liberty and rising hope, of wanting ourselves and our children to come to think of ourselves, to have the story we tell about ourselves, to be the story of proud and loyal citizens of a country that slowly and painfully threw off the yoke of slavery, freed its slaves, enfranchised its women, restrained its robber barons, licensed its trade unions, liberalized its religious practices, and broadened its moral tolerance, and built colleges in which increasing percentages of its population could attend. A country that numbered Jefferson, Thoreau, Susan B. Anthony, Eugene Debs, Rosa Parks, and James Baldwin as among its citizens. This narrative of freedom and hope is a story we can learn to tell better, more boldly, and more robustly. Wordy continues by noting that few people at the turn of the 20th century would have predicted the progressive movement in the 20th century, the 40-hour work week, women's suffrage, the civil rights movement, the successes of second-wave feminism, and now what we've seen, the successes of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights movement. And nobody in 2016 can know that America will not, in the next century, witness even greater moral progress. But there are no guarantees. Only if we act together can we have any hope of achieving what our sixth principle calls the goal of world community, with peace, liberty, and justice. Not for some, but for all. Before I move to my conclusion, I want to share with you just one more of the many passages from Rorty that have really stuck with me even years after I first read them. This quote is from an essay Rorty wrote back in 1996, and it projects 100 years into the future. It's titled, "Looking Backward from the Year 2096. He writes, "Just as 20th century Americans had trouble imagining how could our pre-Civil War ancestors have stomached slavery, so we, at the end of the 21st century, have trouble imagining how our great-grandparents, that's us, could have legally permitted a CEO to get 20 times more than her lowest paid employees. We cannot understand how Americans 100 years ago, that's us, could have tolerated the horrific contrast between a life, a child that grows up in the suburbs and a child that grows up in the ghettos. Such inequalities seem to us evident moral abominations, but the vast majority of our ancestors took them to be regrettable necessities, as their 19th century ancestors took slavery to be just a regrettable necessity." Along with global climate change, wealth inequality is one of the great challenges facing our species today. What stories will we choose to tell that might shape our actions, that might shape the story that we hand on to the generations to come?